Thank you very much for coming. It's good to see such a terrific crowd on a cold February evening. For the second in the series of lectures under the general title of Astronomy Now, Real Stories, or Telescopes Now, sorry, Real Stories of Astronomy Today. The idea being, if you haven't been to the previous one, the idea being that this is derived from the Galileo story. We're celebrating Galileo and the telescope this year, but Galileo had a lot of other political and financial and technical and propagandist work to do to make the telescope work, first of all, but then to get himself published, to get himself noticed, to advance his career. And we imagine that all of those political and human stories and emotional commitment and the need to raise finance and so on might just echo with some of the stories in building telescopes today. So we've invited four eminent astronomers along to tell the stories of their telescopes, or something of the insider view. So it's the story of the telescope, the recent history in some respects. Maybe there'll be some astronomy as well. We don't mind a bit of astronomy if that does come along, but that's not the major point of the lecture series. And how appropriate that John Bilbaink appears in the series, and we're very delighted to have the director of John Bilbaink, Professor Philip Diamond, to speak to us. John Bilbaink, I think, uniquely among science institutions in Britain, has that public affection, that sort of identity that we all sort of share. I don't know if it's a generational thing, but certainly I can see why Phil would have accepted an invitation to come and speak in a historical context, in the context of the history of science, because I think John Bilbaink actually owes a lot. It's a nice example of an institution, in a way that is it going too far? Well, perhaps we'll hear whose salvation owed something to history when it was under threat not so long ago, and that it there was a remarkable upsurge of feeling about the what we would lose, of emotion and so on, what we would lose if we lost John Bilbaink. You're beginning to worry that I'm going to be going on too long. So without further ado, let me welcome Phil Diamond, who's going to talk about John Bilbaink, the Lovell Telescope, E. Merlin, and SKA. He slipped that in at the end. I didn't know about SKA.
Thank you very much, Jim, for that a very nice introduction. And thank you all for coming out to listen to me this evening. It's an honour to be invited to such a venerable institution as a museum, especially in this, the International Year of Astronomy, where we are celebrating 400 years of the first use of a telescope by Galileo. Galileo, of course, didn't have radio telescopes, and I'll tell you a little bit about the history of radio astronomy during this talk. But as Jim has said, what I was asked to focus on, what all the four speakers in this series have been asked to focus on, is really the various problems that are encountered along the way to developing a front-rank scientific instrument, especially an astronomical instrument. So I did add the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array, which is the next generation of telescope that we are currently involved in the planning and the design for, because it does show up a particular set of problems with which many of us, including colleagues here in Oxford, are very closely engaged. So I can give you some feeling of how we are dealing with the various problems that face us now every day. So this is the International Year of Astronomy. There are a whole series of events all over Britain and all over the world, in fact, to celebrate this. It's been adopted by UNESCO, the United Nations, and one of the aims of the International Year of Astronomy is to make astronomy accessible to the public, especially to young people. We're very keen on generating and training the next generation of scientists and hopefully astronomers. So it's very good to see at least one of that next generation sitting here in the front, I might add. which is very unusual. So why explore this particular subject, this particular topic? Well, I have the benefit of having Sir Bernard Lovell, who is now 95, still coming into work twice a week. So I was able to spend an hour or so with him talking over some of these things. But you may know that Sir Bernard has been a fairly prolific author. And one of his books, The Jodrell Bank Telescopes, has a very nice quotation at the beginning, which I will read to you. "Too many people and too many scientists think that a big machine of modern science is built because of a straightforward decision by a council, a committee, or a government department. It is not like that at all. Very rarely are the critical details of the interplay revealed. The historical account of 20th century science tends to become a smooth veneer, a catalogue of instruments and dates. There is no inkling of the cauldron that has boiled beneath the surface." And so what I want to try and give you is a bit of a feel for that cauldron. I think probably that's not the word I would have used. It's a bit strong, but it gives you the idea of some of the things that we have to deal with on a daily basis. So this is the 400th anniversary of Galileo's first use of an astronomical telescope. And as I say there, let us ignore Thomas Harriot of Sussex, who may have beaten Galileo to it, by mapping the moon. It's Galileo's achievement that we're celebrating. Now, for more than 300 years, since Galileo first turned a telescope to the heavens, our view of the universe was limited to a tiny fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. This is the electromagnetic spectrum running from radio all the way to gamma rays. Right in here, this tiny little bit, is the optical spectrum. That's what we see with our eyes, what the atmospheric transmission is designed to let the light through. But of course, longwards of this, longwards in terms of wavelength, is infrared and radio. You see covering a much, much larger region of the electromagnetic spectrum. And then shortwards, ultraviolet, X-rays and gamma rays. Now these can really only be seen from space. Infrared, you typically need to put telescopes on high mountains, as you do really with an optical telescope. Early astronomers did put optical telescopes in their gardens or their estates here in Britain, but it's a waste of time. You just have to look out of the window on any typical day to know that. But a radio telescope can work here in Britain, because at long wavelengths, the radio waves just travel, the atmosphere, the clouds, interstellar dust, it's just transparent to radio waves. So we can have radio telescopes on the ground in the UK and use them very effectively. So until the 1930s, that's 320 odd years after Galileo, there was only one window on the universe, the optical window that I just described. But in the early 1930s, Carl Jansky, an engineer working for Bell Labs in the US on radio telephony, was asked to investigate some interference that was disturbing the measurements that the Bell Lab engineers were taking. And he built this, the world's first radio telescope. Now, it doesn't look like you imagine a radio telescope to be, but with it, he discovered radio emission from beyond the Earth, beyond the solar system. And he opened up a whole new science, and Carl Jansky is remembered as the grandfather of radio astronomy. But in fact, it was this gentleman, Grote Reber, who built what is recognizably a radio telescope in his back garden in Wheaton, Illinois, in 1937, who discovered radio emission from the plane of our galaxy and some of the bright sources in our galaxy. He is really the founding father. So Jansky is the grandfather, but Reber is the father of radio astronomy. He was the first true radio astronomer. He went on to make many measurements. And in fact, he died about 10 years ago in Tasmania after a long career in radio astronomy. So he really was the founding father of the whole thing. Of course, this was 1937, and a little thing called the Second World War intervened in the history of radio astronomy. And many of the people who went on to become radio astronomers were in the universities at that time, and they were pulled into work on radar. Most of them, in fact, worked on radar systems during the war. In all countries, in the UK, in the US, Australia, and in Germany as well, the famous German radio astronomers who built the big telescope at Effelsberg, von Hackenberg, he was a German radar scientist. So these are the two British pioneers. Sir Bernard Lovell, I'm sure you recognise his photograph, and Sir Martin Ryle, his contemporary in Cambridge. And this, in fact, it hasn't come out very well, but there's the RAF roundel on a Halifax bomber, and this is the airborne radar system. This is with the cover taken off that Lovell led the group that developed. Now, the Second World War, of course, provided a huge impetus to the technology that was required to make radio astronomy a reality. Without that technological push, probably it would have taken much longer for the civilian scientists to develop the techniques for radio astronomy. But that aside, the technology was developed, and in 1945, these people returned to their universities, they and their colleagues, and Lovell in particular wanted to try and investigate some of the strange signals he'd actually seen on the first radar screens he was sat in front of on the first day of the war, in September 1939. He'd seen some strange signals then and subsequently during the war. So when he got back to the University of Manchester, he managed to appropriate some army equipment. He's still not clear about where it came from. I think the army had so much equipment at that time they didn't really notice it was missing. But he brought this several truckloads of equipment, including this primitive radar system, into the quadrangle of the physics building in Manchester, but rapidly realised that interference from the trams at that time, the electric trams in Manchester, drove him out into the countryside. And so he searched around for some land that the university owned, and the botany department had a place down at a small village called Jodrell. Well, it wasn't even a village, it was just an area called Jodrell Bank near the village of Lower Withington. These are the botany huts. This is the first day at Jodrell Bank in December the 15th, 1945. This little sapling here is now a full-grown tree. And this, you know, from this time, history was written, really. Very rapidly, Lovell and the colleagues that grew around him realized that the small radar sets they had were not sufficient to detect cosmic radiation, radio radiation. And so they built this first telescope, 218-foot transit telescope, 1947. Now, it may not look like much, but in fact it was a ring of wires which acted as a telescope for receiving very long wavelength radiation. And this tower here was the focus, and they actually moved the tower by pulling these guide ropes so they could look at different parts of the zenith. It was only a transit instrument. Now, this telescope made one fantastic discovery. It discovered radio emission from the Andromeda Galaxy. And this demonstrated that radio emission wasn't confined to our own galaxy. It could be detected from outside our galaxy, and really, I shouldn't use this phrase, but the sky was the limit as regards radio astronomy. So Lovell very rapidly decided he wanted to build a much larger telescope. And in 1951, They wrote a proposal. Now, this is part of the process that we all have to follow, just to get a grant to do some science on an existing telescope, or even to build a mega instrument. So he wrote a proposal to fund a 250-foot steerable paraboloid. And this is, in fact, you can find the proposal, the so-called Blue Book, on our webpage at Jodrell Bank, if you want to go and have a look at it. It's quite fascinating to read it. And this was the original concept. 250-foot steerable paraboloid could see the whole northern sky with a mesh surface. It was going to follow the following science goals, which are listed there. Now, all of us find when we write proposals that, especially for objects which have subjects which have a long lead time, such as facilities or telescopes, that we base the science on the things that we know now. And basically, the Lovell telescope is only known for one of these, and that is its crucial role in determining the structure of our galaxy through observations of hydrogen. I don't think it ever observed the sun. Radar echoes from planets, it was involved in some of that, but it wasn't serious work. Meteors, well, that was Lovell's driving inspiration in terms of astronomy. He was very interested in learning more about meteors. And aurora, again, the telescope was never involved in the study of aurora. So this is fairly typical, we find, of these big projects. But this is what he got. This is the science case that got the funding, and that's the important thing. Now, you've got to realise what the national context was in the 1950s. Britain was bankrupt after World War II, very heavily dependent upon the US Marshall Plan. And you might remember that the loans that the US gave to Britain around that time were only paid off in 2006. I remember a story about it on the BBC. Rationing was still in place. In fact, some of the older people in the room will remember this. Meat was rationed until 1954. National service was the norm for young men until 1963. And Britain, of course, was engaged in a series of costly small wars as we withdrew from the empire. Suez crisis occurred in 1956, just before the telescope was complete. And the Cold War was in full swing, with huge amounts of money going into Britain developing its own hydrogen bomb. Again, to quote Sir Bernard from one of his books, there was one saving factor in this whole thing, and that was the regard in which scientists were held. So as never subsequently, science and scientists were held in the highest regard. We had been crucial to the winning of the war, and there was a facile optimism that we could work similar wonders in peace. I don't think that's true these days, but at that point, he was at a magic time for science. And of course, he had his reputation, he had his contacts from his years in working with the Air Ministry and the development of radar. And he was able to use those personal contacts to obtain the funding for the telescope. So just a few slides to show you what was happening at Jodrell Bank in the mid-1950s as the telescope was constructed. He was a great believer in recycling, and these huge elevation axis wheels, they were actually came off the 14-inch gun turrets on HMS Revenge and Royal Sovereign, and they're still there. Those battleships are long gone, but their crucial parts are still making the Lovell telescope point. You can see the structure as we know it appearing. This, I think, was in 1956 when the bowl is being filled in. Now, you notice a dramatic difference from that picture in the Blue Book. This was a redesign that I'll amplify in a moment. But the surface was decided had to be built as a solid surface, so shorter wavelength radiation could be observed. Otherwise, shorter wavelength would just pass straight through the mesh otherwise. And this is a picture from 1957. Now, I hadn't actually realized that the transit telescope still existed at that point, 10 years after it had discovered Andromeda. So the two did coexist for a while, but I think this was pulled down very shortly thereafter. I hope you can hear this. I won't say anything while it's happening.
The greatest radio telescope in the world is nearing completion. A giant with 2,000 tons of moving parts, surmounted by a reflecting bowl 250 feet across. The object of the bowl? To concentrate radio waves from outer space, so that radiations which have been traveling for millions of years at the speed of light can be detected, measured, and analyzed. To do that, the bowl can be pointed accurately in any direction, even in a high wind. In charge of the station is Professor A.C.B. Lovell, on the right. A strange sea husband designed the telescope, which is operated from a control building. Like many great research centers, it's a university project, in this case, Manchester. In the past quarter century, huge optical telescopes have revolutionized our concept of the universe. But as this radio giant scans the heavens, knowledge which seemed unattainable a few years ago will be an open book. It can operate as a radar set too, probing with its own echoes the moon and even the planets. A new universe to explore, thanks to British scientists and British engineers.
Well, Jim, I should have said I needed some speakers, so I hope you heard that. And those of you of a certain age will remember that pithy voice. The Pathé news reels were very common in the cinemas in, I think, probably until mid-60s or so. But that's a brief summary of how the telescope was built. To come back to the main theme, you may be aware that Lovell had severe financial problems as the telescope was constructed. The original grant for the telescope construction from the government and from the Nuffield Foundation was £335,000, which in modern terms is 6.9 million. But there were several redesigns. First of all, the discovery of the emission line from hydrogen, which was at 21 centimetres, meant that the mesh surface was no longer viable. In order to be able to observe hydrogen, the most common element in the universe, it needed a solid surface. So that was a redesign. What has only become clear in the last few years is that the Air Ministry were also requesting a major redesign of the telescope. Now, Sir Bernard has never been able to talk about this, and only recently has he been able to speak about it. And this, of course, these Air Ministry requests were for national security reasons, because what the Air Ministry realised was this telescope, as a radar dish, could detect ballistic missiles. Also, the fact that such a structure had never been built before necessitated redesigns. And the final cost was double that originally planned, which nowadays, I don't think people building these big projects tend to worry too much about this, but I'll talk a little bit about this more later. But the final cost was £700,000, equivalent to 12 million. Significantly influenced also not just by the redesigns, but by the cost of steel. Now, the government and the university had great difficulty finding this money, especially in the national context that I just mentioned. Charles Husband, who you saw in that clip, the consulting engineer, had not been paid. United Steel, who were providing the steel and the steel workers, had also not been paid, and the workers were on strike. There was a personal lawsuit from Charles Husband against Lovell. I mean, they did make up in the end, and he worked. They worked a lot until Husband's death in the 1970s. And Lovell himself was threatened with jail. It was really only post-Sputnik, in the late 50s, early 60s, that the balance of the debt was paid off by Lord Nuffield. But it was Sputnik that saved the project in the end. And a point that I want to note, I'll come back to it very briefly later, is that considering this was such a novel project, a huge project, it only took 6 years from the proposal in 1951 to first light for a huge science and civil engineering project in a battered, recovering Britain. I think that's an amazing achievement that they were able to drive this huge project through in such a relatively short time. Of course, in 1957, the telescope looked like this, the Mark 1. It's been upgraded since, and I'll show one slide on that. But of course, what saved the telescope, what saved Lovell, what enabled all the financial problems to be paid off, was the Russians launched Sputnik 1 on October the 4th, 1957. And as I said, the workers were on strike at that time, but they all agreed to come back to work. They put the finishing touches to the telescope. It had already driven in azimuth. It was driven in elevation. A radar system was put on. And 8 days after Sputnik was launched, the telescope was able to detect the radar echo off the launch rocket for Sputnik, which was an intercontinental ballistic missile. So the changes that had been put in, that had been asked for by the Air Ministry, were vindicated by this. Unfortunately, the Air Ministry never paid for those changes, which was one of the root causes of Lovell's problems. And I don't think he ever really forgave them. So the telescope itself was upgraded. It looks very different in this picture from the one I just showed you. It was upgraded in 1971. There was a new surface put on. In fact, there's a 30 or 40 foot gap between the old and the new surfaces. There's a great cavern underneath this surface. And an extra wheel girder was added. It was renamed the Lovell Telescope in 1992 to celebrate its 35th anniversary. And in 2002, it was resurfaced and a new control system added. It's a telescope that now has the telescope itself is in good condition. It can survive for many years to come. And of course, all of the electronics in it is now state of the art. So it's still a superb scientific instrument. Now, Lovell had an obsession with big telescopes. I'm going to move on a little bit now from the Mark I. He wasn't really satisfied with a 200-foot diameter telescope. He wanted ever larger dishes because he recognised that the signals being received from space were so weak. And almost before the paint was dry on the Mark I, he was pursuing design funding for actually a huge dish, a large elliptical telescope, 1,500 feet by 500 feet. This project, ultimately called the Mark IV, died. But it did lead to the construction of the Mark II and the Mark III telescopes. This is the Mark II, which you can see is an elliptical design. I think you can just see it in this picture. And the Mark III was very similar. But the Mark III was actually made to be a mobile telescope. It did only move once. It was towed to its location. It never moved, it moved around, pointed around the sky, but it was never transported again. These two telescopes will come back in the history in a few minutes. So Lovell was pursuing this. And in 1960, the Department of Science and Industrial Research asked Lovell and Martin Ryle at Cambridge to prepare a strategic plan for radio astronomy in the UK, because they could see that Lovell was wanting money to build big dishes, and there were activities in Cambridge. There are also activities down at Malvern. And this plan, the strategic plan, was delivered by these two eminent scientists. And they led to the development of aperture synthesis at Cambridge, which ultimately resulted in a Nobel Prize for Martin Ryle, and in a plan for the Mark V telescope, which I'll come onto in a moment, and radio-linked interferometry in Manchester, which ultimately produced Merlin. Now, interestingly, this exercise is underway again. In fact, I think we're on the fourth iteration. And he's not, I don't think he's in here in the audience, but Professor Steve Rawlings from from Oxford, and Paul Alexander from Cambridge, and I are engaged in putting together a modern strategy for radio astronomy in the UK. So these things come around. Maybe one of us will get the Nobel Prize out of this one as well. So the Mark 5 grew out of the defunct Mark 4 program. And initially, Lovell initiated this in 1963. Now initially it was to be a 400 foot telescope, significantly larger than the Mark 1, which could move up and down a railway track, 3/4 mile long railway track, from the Mark 1 telescope, and act as an interferometer. Now what an interferometer is you use two telescopes connected, and essentially what you do, and this is the technique of aperture synthesis that Martin Ryle developed, is rather than building one huge telescope 3/4 mile in size, you build two smaller ones, separate them, and they can actually see the same level of detail as a large dish equal to their separation. And this is a technique called interferometry, which is crucial to the story going forward. Now, his first cost estimate for this telescope was £4 million, which corresponds to £56 million today. This telescope again went through several design iterations, and this the Mark V is a fairly sad story, but with a positive ending, because it was one of great frustration for Lovell. There were two companies bidding to build it. Husband, who he'd worked with on the Mark I telescope, and a new company, I forget their name at the moment. But they had built the Parkes telescope in New South Wales. I don't know if any of you have seen the film, The Dish. It's a fantastic movie. I'd recommend getting it on DVD if you can. But that telescope in New South Wales was built and commissioned in the early 1960s. And so that was one potential design. Another was a large telescope, in a radome to protect it from the elements. A stupid idea was a concrete telescope floating on an artificial lake. I can't believe that Lovell actually wrote this in his book as a serious idea, but apparently it was considered for several weeks before being rejected. Then there was a very clever design, a homologous design, which is a very lightweight telescope that maintains its shape under gravitational distortion. But all of these designs were rejected. And in May 1969, Husband delivered his design document for a 400-foot telescope that would look like this. People here to give you an idea of the scale. Of course, this is a model. It was never built. And we'll come to the story of why that is in the next slide or two. And in January 1970, a £6.2 million project, £69 million in current pounds, was approved. Now, it's very interesting that it was approved but never built, and the reason for that will become clear. So this was, as I said, a study in frustration. They decided not to build it at Jodrell Bank, but to put it further away, in fact about 90 miles away. And that was because through other experiments that were ongoing at Jodrell and other places, it was realized that radio sources were very compact. And to look at very compact sources, you needed a large interferometer, telescope separated by a large baseline. Well, what you've got to imagine is it's a sort of zoom lens effect. If they're close together, it's a wide angle picture. If they're further apart, it's a zoom lens. So, Sir Graham Smith, Lovell's successor as the director of Jodrell Bank and future Astronomer Royal, led the site surveying. He was packed off for the weekend with his wife to explore the English-Welsh border. They found some potential sites. A van was built with some interference testing equipment, but they found wherever they went, when people knew they were from Jodrell Bank and were looking for a site for a new telescope, the locals, when the price of land was asked after, the prices rocketed. So they had to be very discreet. In 1965, they chose a site at Myford near Welshpool. And after a long process, an 8-year process, they obtained planning permission. Now, this is another thing that we're trained as astronomers or engineers. We go out, we write science proposals to seek funding. Getting involved in planning permission arguments is something that I never trained for. In fact, I had a teleconference this morning where a Georgia bank were objecting to the construction of 125-meter-high wind turbines within line of sight of the Georgia Bank telescopes. We don't object to wind turbines in principle, but we object to where they're put if they're going to interfere with our telescopes. So we have to have this sort of broad-ranging view of what's going on, and we have to have access to people with the skills to deal with such things. Lovell was lucky, he did have some people. But the study and frustration continued and politics got involved. Harold Wilson called an election in June 1970 after the telescope funding had been approved, and he lost that election. And the Conservatives came in, Heath became Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher was responsible for science and education. But the Heath government, as many of you will remember from the 1970s, inherited a government, a country with severe financial problems. I think they make our current problems look relatively minor in some regards. And the new Chancellor of the Exchequer was very worried about government expenditure and decided to cut the Research Council's budget. The telescope was de-scoped, and a whole process of delaying on the final approval, the final delivery of the money, then followed. And all of this led to a continual increase in price to a £17 million project. Then there's a very strange chapter title in Lovell's book on this particular subject, The Bogey of European Collaboration. And of course, these days, we're very strongly involved in European collaboration, but in these early days, this was a particular issue for him. The Germans, led by von Hackenberg, his radar opponent in the war, built the 100-meter telescope at Effelsberg using homology, this design concept that Husband had rejected. Cheaper, it was lighter. The British government, through Heath, led by Heath, was looking for European collaboration, and astronomy was one aspect of this. And unbeknownst to the director of the German telescope, UK astronomers were offered 40% of the time on that telescope. And when Lovell informed the Germans of this, they were disgusted. So the politicians were playing games with these telescopes without the astronomers knowing. Anyway, the upshot of all of these delays, all of this politics, was that in June 1974, the Mark V project was unfortunately cancelled. And so that lovely looking telescope never got built. Actually, it's a good thing it never got built. I think it would have been a white elephant. But in fact, what emerged from this was the second strand of research that the Cambridge astronomers had been pursuing, and another group at Georgia Bank had been pursuing, which was interferometry. I've just told you interferometry leads to high resolution through this technique of separating telescopes, equivalent to synthesizing an aperture, the diameter of the distance between them. In the early 60s, there was a scientist at Georgia had a small 25-foot radio telescope, which was towed around to various strategic sites, usually involving pubs, around Cheshire. And this telescope and the Mark I observed the same source in the sky, and the signals were sent back to Georgia Bank, line of sight, using this microwave transmitter. And then the signals from the two telescopes were effectively multiplied together, and measurements could then be made of the compact nature of these radio sources. This is the telescope that Martin Ryle received funding for at Cambridge. Well, there were a whole sequence of telescopes at Cambridge. This is one of them. But he was pursuing interferometers with relatively short baselines and doing surveys of the sky and looking at the large-scale structure of the radio emission. The Jodrell Bank astronomers were pursuing longer baselines and looking at the compact emission. So, in fact, Cambridge, Dutch, Australian and US astronomers were all conducting what we call short baseline interferometers, and at Jodrell we were constructing, I say we, they, I wasn't really interested in astronomy at that time. I think I was only 5 years old when all this was happening. They were using radio telescopes. Now, Henry Palmer is really the man at Jodrell Bank who pushed this particular aspect. And he persuaded Lovell to pursue the construction of an array of telescopes. And a project called MTRLI was born from the ashes of the Mark V. Now, MTRLI stands for Multi-Telescope Radio-Linked Interferometer. It's what became Merlin. The idea was to purchase 3 80-foot dishes from the USA, the same as those that the US were using to construct the Very Large Array, the VLA, in New Mexico. Now, this is a superb instrument. It's actually the best, the most versatile interferometer in the world. These are railway tracks, and these telescopes have 4 configurations. This is the most compact, but they can be moved up and down these railway tracks until they're 35 kilometers apart. Lovell wanted to purchase 3 of these to put them around England to work with the other telescopes that Jodrell Bank had access to build up MTRLI, as it was then called. There were political and financial and logistical problems, but much less of them for this project. Originally, only 1 new telescope was funded, partly through financial constraints, and partly because there was a bit of an academic battle between the Manchester and the Cambridge astronomers at that time, with the Cambridge colleagues expressing some doubt that there were enough compact radio sources to be detected. But in fact, in December of 1977, Tony Hewish withdrew that Cambridge concern, was satisfied that there were enough, and the full project was funded. £5.6 million in 1980, which is about £17 million now. So considerably less money than the big Mark V dish, but actually producing an instrument that is so much more versatile, so much more powerful. And in 1980, MTRLI achieved first science and was renamed Merlin, which is the multi-element radio-linked interferometer network, which is such a better, much better acronym. Was renamed Merlin in 1981. And just on a personal note, I became a PhD student at Jodrell Bank in October 1979, and I was one of the first users of Merlin as a student. Subsequent to my PhD, I did leave Jodrell Bank for 17 years and came back, so I haven't stayed there my whole career. So this is what Merlin looks like now. There are now 7 telescopes. Another one was added in 1990. This is a 32-meter, which is located on the Cambridge Radio Astronomy site at Lord's Bridge. So there are 2 up at Jodrell, the Mark II and the Mark IA, the Lovell. These are the 3 80-foot dishes from the USA, and this is the old Defford dish at Malvern. So this is the 7 telescope network that is Merlin. Now, I've got a little bit of astronomy, because Merlin did some fantastic science in its years of operation, studying things like jets from active galactic nuclei. This is a source called 3C305, 3C being the 3rd Cambridge catalogue. So the 2 groups are working very well together. This is another radio source. You see the supermassive black hole in the center and the jets of radio emission being ejected, forming these huge lobes of synchrotron radiation. Gravitational lenses predicted by Einstein, discovered by my late colleague Dennis Walsh at Georgia Bank in 1979, the year I started there as a PhD student. And this is a Hubble Space Telescope object of an Einstein ring. This is where radiation from a distant quasar is deflected around an intervening galaxy on the way to the Earth. And this is the Merlin image of the same object. You can see the radio emission following the optical emission. And you can learn a huge amount by having optical and radio pictures of the same object. This is GRS 1915, a microquasar that was changing on a daily basis. This is from 29th of October till the 11th of November, Merlin images showing how these jets are thrown off by this binary star. OH masers, these are the looking at circumstellar envelopes around stars like our sun, but much more evolved at the end of their lives. In fact, this is a subject area that I became interested in. Planetary nebulae, this is an infrared image from Gemini North that I believe Roger Davis is going to be talking about in next week's lecture. And this is the equivalent radio image. We don't see the star in the center because stars are not strong radio emitters. But all of this hot gas, thermal emission, synchrotron emission from the material in the planetary nebula. M82, all these little bright components. This is a starburst galaxy, fairly close to us. And all of these little bright spots are supernovae, exploding stars. This is the sort of things that Merlin can see. Merlin evolved into E-Merlin. In January 1999, I came back to the UK after 17 years abroad, and I took over as the director of Merlin. And 6 months after I took over, I initiated the E-Merlin project via a presentation to one of the funding council, PPARC as it was then, one of its committees, building on original ideas by other colleagues at Jodrell Bank, Jim Cohen in particular, who sadly died a few years ago. So what is E-Merlin? It uses the same dishes, the same telescopes, the same metal, but it replaces everything else. That's what you can do with telescopes. They last for decades. But we're using modern state-of-the-art technology. We're essentially broadbanding Merlin. We're throwing away the microwave links because all these photons that travel across the universe to get to us, spend billions of years getting to us, we throw away 99.95% of them because we can't get them from the telescopes back to Jodrell Bank. But with fibre optics, we can. So we have a 650-kilometre fibre optic network in the ground now. It will be transmitting data at 210 gigabits per second. That's three times the total internet traffic of the UK. We have new receivers, new electronics, new software. And with the upgraded Lovell telescope, we're going to be 30 times more powerful than the old Merlin. Now, there's a good history here in the Merlin project. It's from the point of view of the subject, the topic of this lecture, it's an interesting history to go through. And I had an interesting time going through all of my old PowerPoint presentations that I gave to all of the committees as I looked at this. And so, as I said, the first ideas were developed in 95. I came back about here, we formed the E-Merlin working groups, and then we went through a process talking to the funding agency's long-term science review, reporting to an Institute of Physics report on the state of physics in the UK. July 2000, there were a whole spate of stories about Jodrell Bank closing, and it turned out that this was an idea floated by Ian Halliday, the chief executive officer of PPARC. He tells me, just to see how strong the support for Jodrell Bank was. Well, I thought it was a particularly nasty way of acting, and I did tell him so. But it had a positive outcome, as we'll see. There was a science review in the Northwest as the Northwest Development Agency was getting off the ground. We had an international review of Merlin. You spend a lot of time being reviewed in this game. In November 2000, that was a key episode. That was another key episode. And in November 2000, we submitted our science case to PPARC. In fact, you can find this on the web as well, if you want. There are no secrets in here. And I was told by the chairman of PPARC Science Committee that this was the most professional proposal he had ever seen. But they had no money. So we had endless delays over that summer. We had another review by Richard Wade, who's now the deputy chief executive of the current funding council. We went through technical and risk assessments, and eventually we were funded. But how we were funded was a different story from the normal route. So what really happened? Well, we had some cost evolution. We had a gold-plated £16 million project plan in early 2000. This was if we could do everything we wanted. Following some reviews, we reduced this to an £11 million sort of silver-plated budget. And following some get-real discussions with PPARC, we were finally told £8.6 million was what we might get. This was because the UK was joining the European Southern Observatory at this time. The cost for that, I think, this is from memory, was £70 million per year plus £10 million annual subscription. It's an expensive golf club, the European Southern Observatory. The Gemini telescopes are being constructed, and a project called Scuba 2, which is now being installed on the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii, had been approved and was regarded as higher priority than Merlin. It was difficult to argue with that. It was a new area of science being opened up. However, following this scuffle that we had in July and August of 2000, Ian Halliday, the chief executive of PPARC, and Martin Harris, the vice chancellor of the University of Manchester, agreed to a deal splitting the cost for eMerlin between the university, PPARC, and the Northwest Development Agency. Now, of course, I was heavily involved in these discussions. And I'd like to point out that Malcolm Longer and Richard Hills, two professors from Cambridge, plus some colleagues from UMIST, which has now, of course, merged with the University of Manchester, I think were very brave and very far-sighted, because they provided £250,000 each, so from Cambridge and from UMIST, from their science infrastructure funds to support eMerlin. Now, Cambridge could have used that money to support radio astronomy at Lord's Bridge, but it was a very brave decision on their part to support a project at Manchester. Now, the original timeline had eMerlin operational in 2008. It's now going to be 2010. And in truth, back here, we were cut too far. And that's caused delays. £11 million was probably the right number. And when you don't have enough budget, the only thing you can do is really stretch out in time. Time is your contingency. And so that's what we've had to do. And now, of course, in this recent crisis, the Funding Council had the nerve to accuse us of the project being slow in delivery. I have to point out to them that they, of course, caused this right back at the beginning, but they would refuse to accept it. The problems are never far away, so we get it funded, we work hard over the intervening years to pull it together, and of course in March last year, you saw the huge furore in the press, not just focus on us, focus on physics as a whole. But what we found last year, in fact we knew this, what we found was that you have a story about physics, but the Jodrell Bank Telescope, the Lovell Telescope, is the icon. You can go to Rutherford Appleton Labs and show pictures of buildings which have fantastic instruments in them, but they're not photogenic. This is photogenic. So Stephen Hawking leaves Cambridge to go and work in Canada. Next to Stephen Hawking is a picture of the Lovell telescope on the front page of the newspaper. He's nothing to do with the Lovell telescope, but the telescope is the flagship for science and for physics in the UK. But this was a great picture. This is Dave Clark, one of our telescope mechanics, with one of his big spanners. So, you know, it's touch our telescope, we'll come and sort you out, mate, is the image from this. But anyway, there was a lot of work behind the scenes, and I can't really tell you everything that happened, still sub judice. But we have survived. E-Merlin will be completed, and things are moving on there. Now, in the last few minutes, I want to talk a little bit about the Square Kilometre Array, because this is a huge project that's ongoing. It really will be a continental-sized telescope, probably 3,500 12-metre dishes with some very odd-looking phased arrays in the centre. I don't really have time to give you the details. You can look up the SKA on Google, and after you get past the Jamaican reggae music things, you're about the fifth or sixth entry is us. But this builds on all the technologies we've developed over the years. Just a very quick run through the major science goals. SKA will look at the first stars in the universe. It'll do surveys of a billion galaxies in hydrogen to try and understand dark energy and dark matter. It'll be the only telescope that can attempt to understand cosmic magnetism and that role in the evolution of the universe. It will test gravity hopefully to destruction by observing pulsars around black holes, testing physical theories of gravity in extreme environments. Hopefully, it will be able to see the tracks left by Earth-like planets forming around young stars. And of course, the thing that the press are all going to pick up on, but that's only a very minor part of our science case, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Also, exploration of the unknown. We know, as I mentioned at the beginning from these proposals, that we don't know what we're going to find when we build a new telescope like this. So that's one of the great exciting parts of this. I have two slides and then a summary. So the big challenge for the SKA, the major challenge, it's a global project from the start. 19 countries, 55 institutes. In the UK, there's three major players, Manchester, Oxford and Cambridge. Above all, it's science-driven. The original goal of the SKA was to detect hydrogen across the universe. Now, these science goals broadened immensely, as I've just given you a taster, as the community bought into the project. The technology builds on new developments across the world. Dutch phased array system and algorithm development. UK fibre-based data transmission. What we're building for E-Merlin will be the core of the data transmission system for SKA, Australian, US and Canadian efforts as well, and others. The site will be either Australia or South Africa. We've got to go where there are no people. And for example, the core site in Western Australia in Murchison Shire is an area the size of the Netherlands with a permanent population of 4 people. Now, there are no mobile phones there. There are no microwave ovens. The estimated cost is 1.5 billion euros. Now the challenge is that different countries have different science funding schemes. For example, the USA cannot formally talk about the SKA until it's an approved project, which probably happens in 2011. So when we're setting up a decision-making process, which we're doing in 10 days' time in a meeting in South Africa, we have to keep the USA there as an observer, and in fact they influence a lot of the discussions, but they're not formally in the room, they're only informally in the room. Other countries have different approval mechanisms and natural funding timescales. Lining them all up is a major headache. There's a question of what do we do in Europe? Do we go in as 6-7 different countries, or do we form a central organization? And if we do, what central organization is that? Do we use the European Southern Observatory? They're building a huge optical telescope. You know, you run into problems there. When should the site decision be taken? Who should take it? When should it be taken? What's the governance model for the SKA? What structure will we build to run the project? How do we purchase all the various bits of gear we need for the SKA? As I say up here, if we go for the cheapest option, China or India will probably win. But are our governments happy? Are you happy for your tax pounds or euros to be spent that way? Are you more interested in the science or the industrial return? So these are all the things that we're engaged in right now in talking about. We're making decisions on a short time scale because we hope to get funding for the first phase of the SKA in 2012. It's only 3 years away. So, just to summarise, telescopes, big science facilities must always be science driven. I actually think with a project like the Mark V that Sir Bernard Lovell, for all of his great qualities, lost sight of a bit of that. He was pursuing this what turned out to be a white elephant, whereas in the same building, just down the corridor from him, a group at George Will had the right idea. Most modern projects are big science. They're so expensive, and therefore they are international by definition, which brings its own problems, as I've just emphasised. The involvement of and good relations with government officials, politicians, senior university personnel is essential. And you have to avoid sniping at each other in the press, which sometimes happens. The cost, despite all of our best efforts, intentions, estimates, skills in producing costs, they almost always increase. Because these modern instruments are just so complex, you can't predict everything. The efforts and the drive needed requires driven and dedicated people. Just as a personal anecdote, I am actually in the top three people at Manchester for using the university travel agency for travelling. And that is entirely because of the SKA project. If you get involved in one of these things, you've really got to get involved in it all the way, as Lovell demonstrated, and he almost went to jail. So thank you very much for listening.
We did say we'd end it. If anyone wants to slip away, they may, without embarrassment, because that was the idea. But I imagine Phil might take a question or two.
Sure.
If anyone wants to, I have a hand up already.
The SKA, you say you have to have it in an unpopulated area. So once you start building, you're populated.
Only temporarily.
I see you're going to drive out, right?
Yes. In fact, both potential sites, the Australian one, it's about 450 kilometres north-northeast of Geraldton, which is a town of about 30,000 on the Indian Ocean. And in Australia, the core site is in the Karoo Desert in the Northwest Cape, which is a few hundred kilometres from the nearest large conurbation. So when you're building something like this, you'd have the base in the nearest large town, and you'd have temporary work camps as you construct the telescope. But once it's built, there'll be a very small number of people out there just for maintenance. And in fact, with these modern telescopes, the astronomer will almost never visit them. They'll sit at their desks in Oxford and reduce the data. It's a bit sad, really.
Can I ask a question before somebody else puts their hand up? You pointed out at the start that sometimes there's a problem with the science can overtake the initial plans and render the telescope possibly even a white elephant. Isn't it a worry today that the technology can overtake? And how do you build in that kind of problem with technology moving at the speed it does?
Well, absolutely. And for instance, in a project like the SKA, the way we're going to cope with this is we're going to build it in phases. But you have to build renewal in all the time. The problem really is in the electronics. Telecommunications and electronics is being refreshed on timescales of a few years.
Indeed.
Yeah. So you have to accept some degree of obsolescence because you've got to build so much, but then you've got to build in a timescale for renewal as well, and funding for renewal.
Yeah.
If you're faced with some government official who's a decision maker, but who may not be interested in astronomy or even science, and you've got to suddenly try and persuade him to come on your side, so what do you do? What turns people to say, oh, I think that's a wonderful project, we'll commit the government to?
No, that's a question we've been putting a lot of work and a lot of thought into recently, and in fact over the decades. And of course, what these government officials who are not knowledgeable about it, they will ask questions like, well, what does this bring to the UK? What's the benefit to the UK taxpayer? How will this influence the economy? And it's said there are many different answers. I mean, astronomy itself produces technological benefits. For instance, Wi-Fi, the wireless I have here in my laptop, was developed by Australian radio astronomers at CSIRO. That's produced a huge patent for the Australian taxpayer. A lot of imaging algorithms for medical imaging, they have been developed actually by British astronomers. But those are actually only fairly small beer. The crucial thing is trained people. Astronomy and physics and science in general actually brings a lot of youngsters in as undergraduates. Many of them go on to do postgraduate degrees. For instance, at Manchester, we take in, on average, 20 postgraduates every year to do a PhD or a master's degree. Typically, less than 5 of those will go on to do a postdoctoral, get a postdoctoral position. The rest will go out into industry, and they will take the knowledge, the training that they have been given, and take that out into the broader economy. And there have been some studies on this, and it produces it's billions of pounds of injection of benefit to the UK economy every year. And it dwarfs the technical return that we get from the technology developments. So that's an argument that seems to work with government ministers and officials. But we're working very hard on refining these arguments all the time.
Is it too frivolous to ask how important it is to have a good acronym? I mean, Merlin is brilliant.
Yeah, it's magic. Isn't it? Yeah. I don't actually like SKA. I actually have suggested that Jansky would be a better acronym, but my colleagues don't like it. It's, in fact, my version of Jansky is an embedded acronym. It's the joint array for the Nano Jansky Sky. But no, that's not really going to work. But yeah, we're going to have to come up with something.
Last question, Rochelle, Stephen. Yeah.
You said at one point that you hadn't been trained in thinking about planning processes and just at the very end of that last slide, you're thinking to do about keeping a whole range of people on site and on board. Mm-hmm. Do you think would it make a difference to you, your own career? If you had been taught about that, you know, as a student, astronomy is like this, and it will develop into this big science where you do all these management, logistical, and administrative things, would it have encouraged you as a bigger thing?
To be honest, I think it would put most students off. The majority of students are really only interested in science. And if I had thought that this was the route I was going to take, I may never have started. I mean, I still try and do some science, but it's much reduced compared to what I really want. But the thing that we do is you have to try and be the driving force behind the project, but you've got to hire the professionals to handle this. The projects are so big, we need professional project managers, we need professional outreach people, accountants, legal people to deal with these issues of planning permission. And in fact, planning permission is the least of it. We have to deal with satellite companies and they're straying out of the regulations for the interference from satellites down onto the earth. And it's a whole range of skills, and no one person can have it. So you've got to be able to identify it and get the team around you.
Well, I know there was a question right at the back, and this is can be a quick one.
Sorry, I was thinking the budget you're looking at is 1.5 billion, which sounds a lot. Is there military interest with the US budget being the US military defence budget being successful for 400 million?
No, not really. There's military interest in some of the spin-offs of the technology that we develop, but not so much in the telescopes themselves. In fact, NASA has an interest in a specific form of the SKA, using the SKA technology. And that's because when they put robots on Mars or even humans on Mars, they would like to stream high-definition video back. And to do that, you need a collecting area similar to the SKA because you can't put a big transmitter up on Mars. It's too expensive to get it there. So you need a big collector back on Earth. So there are all sorts of other spin-offs from this.
Yeah. Well, Phil, that was brilliant. You took up the challenge brilliantly. You did exactly what we wanted. Thank you very much indeed. That was terrific. Just come back, don't forget to come back next week. When, as you've heard, it's a local lad speaking, Roger Davey is going to talk about the Gemini telescopes. And let's thank Phil once again for a splendid lecture.